This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. If you're a fan of the hip-hop musical Hamilton, you know my guest Jonathan Groff as King George in the original Broadway production and on the cast recording. Children love Groff from the animated musical Frozen, in which he voiced the characters of Kristoff, the ice harvester, and his reindeer Sven. Groff starred in the Broadway musical Spring Awakening opposite Lea Michele and played opposite her in the musical TV series Glee. He starred in the HBO series Looking, about a group of gay friends. Now he's added another genre to his resume, crime stories. In the new Netflix series Mindhunter, he plays an FBI agent trying to understand the minds of convicted serial killers to better understand how to identify and track down other killers. It's based on the stories of the two FBI agents who first developed the technique of psychological profiling. David Fincher is an executive producer and a director on the series. In this scene from Mindhunter, Groff's character, Agent Holden Ford, is in a state prison medical facility where he's conducting his first interview of a convicted serial killer. The killer, Edmund Kemper, was known as the co-ed killer because he killed six college students as well as his mother. Kemper is played by Cameron Britton. This clip begins with Groff's character, Agent Ford, explaining to Kemper the purpose of his visit.
Well, it's more of a research thing.
Research?
Just a series of interviews, chatting with individuals not unlike yourself.
We're just talking. I don't get to go someplace, do a bunch of tests.
No, yeah, no tests, just right here.
Why?
Well, because I believe it could be useful.
Talking about what?
Well, I don't know. Your behavior, I guess. If you want to, that is. I mean, we don't have to talk about anything at all if you don't want to.
Why are you so tense?
Hmm?
You're tense right now.
No, I'm not tense.
You're tense. Jonathan Groff, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for having me. I'm such a fan.
So among the serial killers, Ed Kemper, who we just heard you interviewing in the fictionalized version, you know, he abducted several female hitchhikers, killed them, engaged in necrophilia and cannibalism, killed his mother. That's an example of the type of killer who you're interviewing in this. What kind of research did you do for the role?
I started by reading the book Mindhunter, written by John Douglas, who my character is inspired by. And he really lays it all out in that book, specifically his journey, but also emotionally the kind of toll that talking to the serial killers, and he even says more so talking to the victims, had on him in his life. And he did have a total mental and physical breakdown. And then we had like rehearsal in Pittsburgh, so which was great. I was doing Hamilton when I got the part, and then I left early to go to LA and to Pittsburgh. And so then we had a couple of weeks of rehearsal with David, and then we jumped right in.
So you were in the cast of Hamilton on Broadway when you got the part for Mindhunter. Let's talk a little bit about Hamilton. So you played King George, a.k.a. the
yes.
white guy in the cast.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you're the king, and the whole Revolutionary War is about cutting ties with you. So you're like the bad guy, but you're also like the comic relief in the show. So how come your character is funny as opposed to more of a threat?
It's this idea that Lynn had that King George would sing the equivalent of kind of a breakup song. You know, it's called You'll Be Back. And so the moment when we see King George is the first kind of comedy moment in the show, and there hasn't been one up to that point. And it's interesting because I think the audience watching the show is digesting a lot. They're digesting a lot of words because of the rapping. And they're also seeing these historical figures visually in a way that they've never experienced them before. We're used to seeing pictures of them as old white men. And here they are, young, vibrant, and the opposite of white. And so when King George comes out about 20 minutes into the first act, And then he comes out and you just immediately know what his perspective is because we all know the history. And then he sings this sort of Beatles-esque song. So it's this melody that's uncomplicated and familiar. And then on top of all of it, Lynn throws in this this idea of, you know what, I know you've left me, but you'll be back. And it's that sort of passive-aggressive British thing where he's talking about killing your friends and family, but sort of ending it with da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's this this like sweet kind of jaunty melody. So I think all of that put together provides the humor of that moment.
Well, we should hear you sing as King George, You'll Be Back, the breakup song that that you were referring to. So this is my guest, Jonathan Groff, in the original cast recording of Hamilton.
You say the price of my love is not a price that you're willing to pay. You cry in your tea, which you hurl in the sea when you see me go by. Why so sad? Remember we made an arrangement when you went away. Now you're making me mad. Remember, despite our estrangement, I'm your man. You'll be back soon, you'll see. You remember you belong to me. You'll be back, time will tell. You remember that I served you well. Oceans rise, empires fall. We have seen each other through it all. And when push comes to shove, I will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of my love. Da 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 da.
So that's Jonathan Groff in the cast recording of Hamilton as King George. You should describe what you wore on stage for that song.
It was exactly what you see in pictures of King George. So it was the white wig, the white powdered wig, a giant crown, a huge cape covering the, like, king outfit. I also had a scepter that I hid underneath my cape that I revealed at a particular moment during the song. So it's a very opulent, giant costume, a sensible, you know, inch and a half heel. Paul Tazewell is the costume designer. Incredible.
I think maybe in part because of the costume, King George comes off a little bit like Queen George.
It's funny you say that because I feel like that maybe is a little bit of my added element to the character.
Okay, yeah, so tell me about that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, because it's interesting because when I originally saw the show, I saw Brian D'Arcy James and I was pulling my hair out a little bit because he came out kind of like Napoleon. You know, he's got these hilarious giant eyebrows. The crown like sits on top of his eyebrows and he's got these legs that just are innately funny when he walks out. And just the expression on his face, and he just was hilarious in this broad kind of genius vaudevillian way. And I thought to myself, I can't do that. I wonder why they hired me. He's a totally different physical type than me. He's older than me. We're just completely different beings. And when I jumped into the show, the sort of revelation that I had was I was watching these clips of Barbra Streisand on YouTube, these old clips from her television special from like the very early 60s, when she was like 22 years old or something. And this one clip in particular of her singing this song, When the Sun Comes Out, and the newscaster goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, once again, Barbra Streisand." And she walks out and it's one shot. There's no cutaways. And she comes all the way down center and she sings the song. And it's like she's having sex with herself with her own voice is what it feels like to me while I'm watching this. It's just, she has extreme power and control, and there's this sensuality that she has while she's singing. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to myself with my own voice as King George, and that is the energy that I'm going to bring to my performance. And so perhaps the kind of like the vibe that you were getting when you say it's more of a Queen George than a King George is me trying to channel my inner Barbra Streisand.
That's really funny. So you mentioned that the song that you sing is kind of British Invasion, but I have to say the melody reminds me of the Monkees song Daydream Believer. Do you know that song?
Yeah. Daydream Believer. Yeah, of course.
But it's the first part that really reminds me of it.
Oh, wait. It's sing the first part for me. How does it go?
Very much like the melody. I would sing it, but I would just be mocked. And I don't remember the words, but it's the same melody. I'm going to look it up. Hang on. Okay. I could hide neath the wings of the bluebird as she sings. I'm so off key.
Okay, first of all, Terry, you have great pitch.
No, I have terrible pitch, but that's similar, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. And it's like, you'll be back soon, you'll see, you'll remember. Yes, it's very similar. I sort of had forgotten about the opening of that song, but you're exactly right.
And the Monkees.
It is very similar.
And the Monkees are kind of like the fake British Invasion.
Yeah, totally, totally. It's like a ripoff of a ripoff.
Yeah. It's funny. So what was it like to be the white guy in the cast of Hamilton?
Incredible. It was great. It's so funny you say that because at one point, they gave us somebody, I think it was one of the dancers, I think it was Betsy, who funnily was another, like the other white person in Hamilton in the ensemble. But she gave us all the Ta-Nehisi Coates book, Between the World and Me. And I did a lot of reading backstage because I was only on stage for 9 minutes. And I read that book and I was like, oh my God, I really am representing like white supremacy in so many ways in this show, being the king. And then also funnily enough, only working for 9 minutes while everybody else is like busting their ass on stage. So it was weirdly symbolic in many ways.
My guest is Jonathan Groff. He's now starring in the Netflix series Mindhunter. He was King George in Hamilton on Broadway, and he was Kristoff and his reindeer Sven in the animated film Frozen. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break, and Maureen Carrigan will review a new collection of short stories by Tom Hanks and a new novel by Matthew Weiner, the creator of the series Mad Men. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Groff, who stars as an FBI agent in the new Netflix series Mindhunter. He also starred in Hamilton as King George and is on the cast recording. In the Disney animated musical Frozen, he did the voices of the ice harvester Kristoff and his reindeer Sven. He starred in the Broadway musical Spring Awakening and starred in the HBO series Looking about a group of gay friends. So I find it really interesting that, you know, adults and teenagers who love Hamilton and were obsessed with Hamilton, while that's going on, there's children who are obsessed with Frozen and listening to that over and over in the same way that other people are listening to Hamilton over and over, and you're on both of those. That must have been odd for you to have these two separate identities, you know, one in a hip-hop musical and the other in an animated kids musical, also knowing that people were obsessed with both of them and here listening to them over and over.
It's so cool. You never know if something's going to be a success, and then in the particular case of Hamilton and Frozen, like a kind of worldwide phenomenon. You know, it's all about timing and luck. For me, it's especially cool because I grew up in Pennsylvania, dreaming of being on Broadway. I also was Mary Poppins for Halloween when I was 3 years old, and dressed up like Peter Pan for two Halloweens in a row. So I was a big Disney kid.
So I have to ask you, when you're dressed up as Mary Poppins for Halloween, did your parents think, oh my God, he's dressing as a girl, what does that mean?
I know you would think that when I eventually came out, they were like, I think we knew at three when you wanted to be Mary Poppins, but but they were shocked. It's really like, I still thank my mom to this day for letting me do it. She didn't bat an eye. She was just all about letting us express ourselves however we wanted to, which was amazing.
Were you singing at age three?
I was singing at age three. There's a video of me singing, you know, just a spoonful of sugar with it, holding my carpet bag and dressed as Mary Poppins. And as Cinderella, I went through like a very intense drag phase from, I would say, like three to five, it was Cinderella in my own little corner, you know, really intense. And now I'm gay, but I don't have that deep, like, drag desire anymore. It's like I did it, you know, from three to five, and then it's not something that's been calling to me in recent years, but I guess you never know.
No, I have to ask you, you didn't come out to your parents or publicly till you were in your 20s, until I think after you were in Spring Awakening. Do I have that right?
Yeah, correct.
And so it's interesting, like, Broadway seems to me like it would be one of the most safe places in all of entertainment to come out, because, I mean, like, historically there have been so many gay men, you know, on stage and behind the scenes in Broadway.
Totally.
Were you not ready, or did it not feel comfortable enough?
Well, it was sort of a combination of things, and really specific, as it is to everyone.
I didn't mean that in any kind of critical way. I just meant like that's...
Oh my God, I don't feel that you were being critical at all.
It's just like,
oh my
that's
God.
That's a relatively safe space as far as things
go. Are you
go.
Kidding me? Yeah, it's like everyone here is gay.
Exactly.
Isn't this
right.
like the easiest place to... I know exactly what you're talking about. Oh my God, no. But specifically, you know, I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, moved to New York when I was 19, and I immediately started dating someone who was also from my same hometown. And we were together for 3.5 years, and he was my, if you could see me, I'm doing air quotes right now, he was my roommate, right? And so within the four walls of my apartment, we could be in this relationship, but then outside, I didn't have to define who I was. And so when I was 20 years old, I got cast in Spring Awakening and got swept up in this experience where, you know, it was kind of tunnel vision. We were working. It was nonstop. We were all really young. And even throughout the course of that entire, you know, I did that show for about 2 years in total, including Off-Broadway, I was completely in the closet. And I was able to live this very compartmentalized life where I would go to work. And weirdly, the show was very sexual and about sexual awakening, and I was having sex with Lea Michele on stage and getting her pregnant. You know, it was a very sexual show. And yet, I was very asexual in my life, and then I could go home to my boyfriend, and we could be gay together in the sort of four walls of our apartment. And then, this sounds kind of cheesy, but when the show was over, I was playing this character, Melchior Gabor, who was a rebel and who, you know, was a person that didn't let the world define him and who stood up to authority and was this kind of revolutionary. And I'm in life, still am to a certain extent, but especially at that time, was this kind of smiley people pleaser who was afraid always of rocking the boat or creating waves in any way. And when I left Spring Awakening, I came out of that experience feeling like, this is sounds so like wanky and actory, but it's true. Like I'd like cultivated this side of my personality that hadn't existed before. And I left Spring Awakening, and within a month of leaving the show, I came out to my parents and to my friends and broke up with my boyfriend and moved into an apartment of my own and completely changed my life.
Were your parents surprised when you came out?
My dad was shocked, and my brother was shocked. But my mom had an inkling.
When your father was shocked, was he upset shocked or just surprised shocked?
Weirdly, he was not upset shocked. He was so, it was kind of amazing, actually. I had come out to him, and he sort of took a long pause, and he was like, so that's what you've been dealing with. He was very, you know, he created a lot of space for me, and I'm sure was having a lot of feelings on his own, but in the actual moment of coming out, he was really, really amazing to me.
You come from a pretty religious background, right? Your father is Mennonite and your mother Methodist?
Yeah, wow. Yes, I'm impressed that you know that. Yeah, my dad is Mennonite and my mom is Methodist. We were raised Methodist, but my dad's whole side of the family is Mennonite, which is like watered down Amish.
Yeah, but like Amish people usually wear, you know, like the women have often have bonnets, the men grow long beards. They don't use technology. They usually live in their own community, cut off from the rest of the world, except maybe for the farmers markets.
Exactly.
They come out for it with like fabulous produce. But Mennonites don't dress from another century in the same way.
Correct. Yeah, Mennonites drive cars and have electricity, and the sort of connection in a lot of ways is that a lot of Mennonites in Lancaster, there are a lot of farmers, and so there's this sort of bridge between the Mennonite and the Amish community, because the Mennonites are still, you know, conservative and religious, and the Amish can ride in cars but not drive them or own them, so the Mennonites kind of end up becoming this bridge between the Amish and the modern world. So like my grandmother, who was full Mennonite, would have Amish women, you know, cleaning her house and working in her garden. Then I would mow my grandmother's lawn, and then I would drive the Amish women back to their farms. So I was like, I was like the Amish lady chauffeur.
Well, your mother had to drive you around to auditions because you were actually in shows as a kid, right?
Yeah, exactly. Not until my first one was 14, so I wasn't like a child actor, but yes, once I was in, just left middle school, I started doing community theater and stuff. That was a big thing, driving, you say that, it does sound like a small thing, driving your kids around, but it's a huge commitment. And it is the gateway between me having the life that I had and not, is the simple thing of having my parents drive me to and from the theater. That simple act changed the whole course of my life, because they were driving me to this theater called the Fulton Opera House in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where I sort of learned about moving to New York and learned about theater. And if I hadn't had that experience, my entire life would be different, because I moved to New York right after high school, and I wouldn't have done that had I not had the experience of working in that theater in my hometown.
Did you have an audition number that you would always do as a kid?
I sang "If I Were a Rich Man" from Fiddler on the Roof. That was my first audition song.
Because you're half Mennonite.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you had to do all the yiddle diddle stuff?
Yeah. I did. I did the diddle 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 dum. Yeah, the whole, yeah, I did "If I Were Rich Man." So weird. As a 14-year-old, that was my, like, go-to.
That's
number.
So funny. Like, as a 14-year-old, you're playing this older man on this older Jewish man on a shtetl.
I know, right?
Why did you
it
choose
works.
That? Of all the songs in the world, why "If I Were
I
Rich
just
Man?
Loved Fiddler on the Roof. I loved Fiddler on the Roof.
Well, it's so a great
funny.
Show. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Jonathan Groff, it's just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's such an honor to get to talk to you.
Jonathan Groff stars in the new Netflix series Mindhunter. All 10 episodes are available. The show's been renewed for a second season. Famous names sell books, but they also stir up skepticism, especially when the famous name is a Hollywood star. So let's see what our book critic Maureen Corrigan has to say about two new books, one by Tom Hanks and the other by the creator of the series Mad Men, Matthew Weiner.
So, is it any good? That's the question everybody asks whenever a celebrity writes a work of fiction. No one expects much from debut novels written by rhinestone in the rough wordsmiths like Fabio or Snooki from the Jersey Shore. But the work of other Hollywood stars like James Franco, Lauren Graham, and Steve Martin has garnered some serious attention. Which brings us to Tom Hanks's debut collection of short stories called Uncommon Type. So, is it any good? Yeah, I think so. As you'd expect, Hanks isn't interested in experimenting with a short story form. After all, he's a guy who's still obsessed with typewriters. In fact, every one of the 17 stories in this collection features a typewriter. As often happens in large short story collections, a few of these tales should have been whited out. And if you don't know what that term means, you're not in the target age range to enjoy most of the remaining stories, a few of which are really wonderful. Hanks's strength as a writer is pretty much the same as his strength as an actor. He totally embraces his own earnestness. His language and references are unaffected, sometimes even Forrest Gump goofy. In a story called A Month on Green Street, his main character, a newly divorced mom, utters expressions like yowza and howdy do. And in another called Three Exhausting Weeks, about a frantic love affair, our hero, a millennial, drinks percolated coffee. Most of Hank's stories end optimistically, which contributes to their gentle appeal. But the one I'm haunted by is called Christmas Eve, 1953. It doesn't so much celebrate optimism as it does that other old-fashioned virtue, sucking it up. It's about the guys who were lucky enough to come home from World War II and the things they carried into their middle-aged lives. A father of three named Virgil Buell is driving home on Christmas Eve and cursing the folks at Plymouth who are unable to build a car with a heater worth a damn. By story's end, we understand why Virgil, a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge, has lavished money he and his family don't have on an oversized furnace and a beast of a hot water heater. We also understand that cold has permanently settled in Virgil's bones, even as he acknowledges he's one of the lucky ones. In all, I liked Hank's collection a lot, which sounds as if I'm damning it with faint praise. I'm not. Like is a Hank's kind of word, simple and earnest, which are two words you would never use in talking about Matthew Weiner's work. Weiner, who created Mad Men and wrote and directed many of its episodes, has just written a novella called Heather the Totality. It's about two upper-class New Yorkers named Mark and Karen Breakstone and their 14-year-old daughter, Heather. Heather is graced with an unusual degree of empathy. As a little kid, she once caused a woman, a stranger, to burst into tears on the subway by remarking to her, "Everybody riding on the train acts like they're alone, but they're not." Now, Heather's empathy and teenaged beauty have attracted more sinister attention. Here's the moment when Mark spots the danger lurking near his daughter in the form of a construction worker outside his Upper East Side apartment house. As he was about to cross the street to his apartment, he froze. Heather was staring at her phone, and one of the workers was staring at her. The stare was coming from a short guy in a work apron and was so carnal and intense that Mark charged across the street and pushed Heather away, as if he were stepping between her and an oncoming car. Given that Mad Men was routinely referred to as a televised epic novel, you'd expect that Weiner's foray into literary fiction would be pretty good, and it is. There's a noirish, over-the-top quality to this story, especially at the end, that's a little reminiscent of James M. Cain's signature tone. But as he did throughout Mad Men, Weiner also deftly exposes the weirdness of mundane life changes, the transformation of a chatty toddler into a shut-down adolescent, the sudden shifting of allegiances among closed groups, whether they be ad agencies or nuclear families. Like Hank's stories, Heather the Totality doesn't break any new ground stylistically. Instead, it chillingly reminds us of how unstable the ground is that we take for granted beneath our feet.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Uncommon Type by Tom Hanks and Heather the Totality by Matthew Weiner. Coming up, We hear from humorist and actor John Hodgman. He's been a contributor to This American Life, and on The Daily Show, he appeared in the personas of the resident expert and the deranged millionaire. He gets personal in his new collection of essays. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. My guest, John Hodgman, is an author, humorist, and actor. He joined The Daily Show in the Jon Stewart era, where he was a commentator who appeared in the roles of the deranged millionaire and the resident expert. On public radio, he's contributed stories to This American Life. He's written several best-selling books of fake facts and made-up history. And you may also remember him from his appearances in Apple's Get a Mac TV ad campaign, where he played a stuffy, old-fashioned PC, and Justin Long played a young, hip Mac. Now Hodgman has a new collection of humorous personal essays called Vacation Land. John Hodgman, welcome to Fresh Air.
It is absolutely my pleasure to be here.
And my pleasure to have you. I want to start with a reading from your new book. Let me set it up a little bit. This is a reading in an essay that you wrote about buying a summer home in Maine after already having inherited your parents' summer home in Massachusetts and realizing you're now not only an adult, but you're the guy with two summer homes, and you're feeling pretty uncomfortable about that and feeling like that you don't fit in with your new neighbors in Maine, and you're thinking, I don't belong here. I'm young. I'm cool. And then you realize you did belong there. So you
that is a very accurate description, such to the point that the hairs are raising on my arms.
So you want to pick it up from there with the reading?
I will. I'm happy to read from there. There are times when all the lies you have told about yourself to yourself just fall away. In your 20s, you tell yourself the lie that you are unusual, unprecedented, and interesting. You do this largely by purchasing things or stealing things. You adorn yourself with songs and clothes and borrowed ideas and poses. In your 30s, you tell yourself the lie that you are still in your 20s. Many in their 40s tell themselves the same lie until a moment like this, and suddenly you see yourself clearly. Yes, I went to see Public Enemy in a small club in 1990 by myself, which was pretty cool of me. But less cool now that I remember I saw them at Toad's Place in New Haven while attending Yale University. Yes, I shoplifted some off-brand beers and snuck into the London Zoo when I was in my 20s, but only now do I realize that I did so with full, if unconscious, confidence that I would not be executed in the street for doing these things. Yes, my parents came from modest working middle-class families, but I have never truly wanted for anything in my life. I don't say these things to flay myself for my many privileges, just to draw out the truth and see it.
Thanks for reading that. You know, so I was thinking, reading your book, about the different masks we all put on and the poses we take through life. And mm-hmm. you became famous for your personas, you know, on The Daily Show, and in the Mac commercials, and as the historian collecting fake facts.
Yeah.
So how did you start getting more personal and like taking off some of the masks and revealing things about who you, John Hodgman, really are, like you do in the book?
Yeah, so the exaggerations of those characters were how I imagined that I made myself and what I had to say interesting. When I went and first started performing more personal, straightforward stories of my own, I felt a little ashamed of myself because everyone's got an autobiography. Why should mine be interesting? Why should my being a regular human and husband and father to two human children be interesting at all? But the fact of the matter was that it was all that I had. There was nothing left in this weird fake trivia world for me.
But it seems to me you had personas that you stood behind before The Daily Show. For example, like you write in the book that when you were in high school, you had shoulder-length hair, you wore a fedora and a bow tie and carried a briefcase. So
I just want to say, for the record, the bow tie was really just once or twice, but I will cop to the rest of that stuff.
Okay.
That was everyday apparel for me as I went to high school, and it is really a question that looms in my mind is why I was not bullied more or teased more.
But what were you trying to convey? I mean, you were looking like either an older professor or an older businessman from another era. So why were you wearing it?
So I am an only child. And I wanted to be interesting. So the idea that I grew up with was the fear that any sort of conflict or disagreement or any sort of high tension confrontation, including a fight or hugging and kissing another person, all seemed fatal to me, terrifying. So I wanted to be interesting, and I wanted to, once I turned about 13, I wanted to jump over sexual adolescence and become the sexless gentleman bachelor of about 39 that felt very comfortable to me. I mean, it's not a surprise that I dressed like Doctor Who, very specifically the fourth Doctor Who, played by Tom Baker, and wore that long scarf, because Doctor Who was this man who had absolutely no emotional connection to anyone around him, and could travel around and escape from any conflict in a magic box whenever he needed to. So that's the look I was going for in high school, which was emotionally terrified weirdo who was tricking people into thinking he was interesting by wearing funny clothes.
It also seems to me you were kind of like removing yourself emotionally by putting quotation marks around yourself, by wearing a kind of ironic costume, and making that like your brand.
I guess my hope was in the most base way that people would say, that guy's interesting, let me talk to him. Because I did want to reach out to people, but mm-hmm. I was also very, very nervous and shy.
Did people reach out to you because of what you were wearing?
I think I prompted a lot of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
I think of, and I made a lot of friends who also, I think, felt out of place in adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
Including the woman who is now my wife. We met in high school. We were friends in a gang of friends who were terrified of hugging and kissing other people. And
were you terrified of hugging and kissing each other?
Yeah, of course, because that was going to really upset the balance of the friend group.
Right.
But luckily for me, certainly, and I hope she feels the same way, we overcame our fear and really upset the apple cart and fell in love with each other.
I want to talk about a turning point in your life when you were 29 and working as a literary agent before you became a professional writer.
Right.
And your mother was diagnosed with lung cancer and died within 8 months. And you left your job for a few weeks to be with her. I think it was a few weeks.
A couple months. Yeah.
And just to give a sense of who she was, you tell this great story about after you saw The Exorcist. And you were really, because you were a kid, and you were really afraid, like, the devil was going to get you.
Yeah.
Tell us how your mother reassured you.
The Exorcist terrified me because as an only child, I believed that if I followed the rules, I would get universal approval and love from everyone on earth. But possession by the devil didn't care what rules you followed. He might just take you over and you'd become a bad person. And I would lie awake at night waiting for my bed to start shaking, because that's what happened in The Exorcist when the character was being possessed by the devil. And eventually it would shake because my heart was beating so hard and it was causing the bed to tremble. And I ran into my mom and I must have been about 11 or 12. And I said, I'm terrified of the devil possessing me. And she was in bed reading and smoking, the two things she did in bed all the time. And she said, well, you don't need to worry about that because there is no devil. And I said, oh, that's good to know. She said, yes, you don't know this, but I'm an atheist. I became an atheist after I left home. So I know there is no devil because there also is no God. And I'm like, I know you're trying to be comforting to me, but that's more, it's not a comfort to me exactly in this moment. Can I sleep in here? No. Okay. I'll just go back and listen to soft rock until I fall asleep.
had you believed in God before that moment?
I had no reason not to believe in God. It had not occurred to me that I shouldn't. We were not a religious family, but every culture creates a myth to reassure us that there is something beyond these meat bodies that we inhabit. And I certainly didn't want to be possessed by the devil, so I had to hope there was some God out there protecting me, and now I knew there was nothing. So thanks, Mom. But, she was funny when she said it, too. I mean, I remember it now. I'm like, that's funny. That was a funny joke to play on a child. But it was also unnerving and smart, and that's who she was.
So what impact did that have on you?
I'm sorry to pause, and just, I don't know. I haven't thought about it.
Okay, that's a fair enough answer.
Yeah. I mean, I thought a lot about what belief was. Once my mom said that she was an atheist, I wondered if I had to be. Like, was that,
right,
was that
that's
part,
true.
Of, the, part
right.
of the obligation?
Right. So you had to think that through for yourself.
Yeah. And, you know,
you were suddenly faced with a choice you didn't know you had to make.
Right. And, you know, immediately, once someone says, yeah, there's no God, it's like, oh, right. That's, now that you mention it, that's the whole, that whole story doesn't make sense in a lot of ways. So why do people believe in it? And I guess I ended up thinking for some time about what it meant to be atheist or agnostic or faithful. And my basic, the thing that I came to was that I believe that there is probably stuff outside our perception that we can't see or articulate yet, because that is a scientific belief, that there might be more than we know. But as I get older, I kind of end up feeling like, yeah, there's nothing.
Oh, really?
We'll see what happens. Yeah. We'll see what happens. I think I remember, just now that I think of it, I remember sitting on the subway when I was probably in my mid-teens going, well, I guess I'll find out eventually, one way or the other.
So I found this interesting. Even though your mother was a self-described atheist, when she was dying, she started reciting the Lord's Prayer. And did you ask her why she was doing that?
Toward the end of her illness, she had lung cancer, and her mind was not what it was by the end. And it's hard for me to know how much of that was the medication that she was taking or just the the deterioration of her facilities. But she would say the Lord's Prayer, and we would say it with her. And in the book I say, I think, she may have been sincerely returning to a kind of faith, or she may have been hedging her bets the way I did when I was a teenager by saying, oh, we'll find out. I don't want to take any chances. I better say this thing. But more, it was an opportunity, I think, very plainly in the room when I was there. She was at home and my dad was there and my then girlfriend, well, actually my wife, we had just been married when my mom was diagnosed, now that I think of it, to say those words together and feel less alone. And that's what prayer is, and that's what the best part of religion is, to feel less alone.
So let me get to something more cheerful.
Sure. Oh, by the way, this is a really funny book, everybody.
Yeah. Yes. Well, it is. As you've mentioned, you were an only child.
Yes.
You have two children. Did you want to make sure your child was not an only child?
No. I wanted to have one child, of course. Only children, you have to understand that for all of my self-deprecation, I'm a narcissist. I'm a narcissist who is ashamed of being a narcissist. I grew up that way. I was obsessed with myself, and I didn't appreciate how love could be distributed among two different children, never mind having an extra person in my marriage. Do you know? Objectively, I knew that I wanted to have children, but my wife really had to say, this is happening, and it's not going to happen 5 years from now. It's happening now. And I said, okay. And then we had our daughter, and that was a very good experience. And when she said, I would like to have another child, I was like, that's impossible. There can only be one. And she said, no. And I said, well, you were right the first time, so I'm going to have to step on faith that you're correct the second time, that I can split my love between two, not only two, but now three human beings. And it worked out. We had our son, and that's also been a largely positive experience, I would say.
How old are they now?
I have no idea. They're 15 and 12.
Okay. So one of the things you write about in the book is crossing over into middle age. You're in your 40s now.
Yes.
Like mid-40s?
I was born on June 3rd, 1971. I'm 46 years old.
Okay.
All of these things are verifiable.
That's what the internet is for.
It is. I would like to say mid-40s, but I'm 46, and in 2 seconds, I'm going to be 47, and in 4 seconds, I'm going to be 50. Time moves faster, and it just feels better to just say it.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you write about how easy it is to convince yourself you're still young, in your 20s, yeah, and then in your 30s and in your early 40s. And, of course, young people know that you're truly young people know that you're not young as you get older. But still, like, is it an interesting period for you to become middle-aged? I mean, are you seeing yourself in a different way or seeing your future in a different way?
Young people know that I'm not young. It is easy when you live in New York to trick yourself into thinking that you're still young because you never have to learn to drive if you don't want to, and everyone's living in apartments, and so essentially they're all glorified dorm rooms, and the people at the coffee shop also have bad beards, and, you know, we kind of, and they're dressing like old men the way I used to dress like. And I remember the moment, the distinct moment of horrible clarity when I was just chatting with the young barista and making jokes that I thought everyone enjoyed. And she was wearing overalls, and I said, hey, you know what? Those are cool overalls. I believe you deserve a prize in the category of overall excellence. And she stared at me, and she said, nice dad joke. And that's how I died. That was the day I died. I'm a ghost now. I was killed. I was destroyed by that because I suddenly saw, like, okay, first of all, a terrible joke. That is a total corny dad joke. Second of all, we're not the same. She's a young woman. You shouldn't be commenting on the way she dresses anyway. That's creepy and weird. Get out of here, you weird dad. Go away as far away as possible. Go to Maine as quickly as possible. So, yeah, I mean, it's easy to trick yourself into thinking that you're young, but when you realize that you're old, there are some condolences, of course, because then you realize you have some experience and you realize that no one's really thinking about you as much as you worry they're thinking about you. Most people are just thinking about themselves all the time. So why not just be who you are and not worry about what you do or what you're wearing or what you're saying or the poses that you're stealing or the ideas that you have. Just go ahead and be yourself and not worry about it. And that is a relief, even for a person who was basically enabled by his parents to be a weirdo his entire life. There is still a great exhalation that comes when you don't care what young people think about you anymore, that they just are going to think that you're a dad joke telling weirdo anyway.
John Hodgman, I've really enjoyed talking with you and getting to know you.
Let me say it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, and such a fan of the show. And
thank you so much. Yeah. Well, back at you, and thank you for doing it.
Thank you so much.
John Hodgman's new collection of humorous personal essays is called Vacation Land. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.